Welcome into another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. Dan is on the line, as is the Lil Scout guy, Brian Snow. Gentlemen, it's been a while since we last talked. I think, you know, we've got a lot to get to in terms of Xavier information, but before we do that, we've got to talk about what everyone wants to talk about, which is Brian's version of Temecula. Snow, what happened between you and one Dan Dockich?
We're not real big fans of each other.
Why is that? He seems like a level-headed guy.
You know, I just kind of like, if you're going to show your ass, you know, like, I'm going to go at your head. It wasn't like, you know, like, I wasn't like mad. I was having fun.
No, you clearly seemed not mad at all when you...
Just to be clear, you were not mad. You were actually laughing.
Oh, I was having a hell of a time.
Snow, when you listed your cross streets for Dan Dockich, what was the percentage chance you thought he might show up to challenge you to a fisticuffs?
Zero. I mean, like, his whole thing is like, I walk out of the radio station at 3 o'clock every day. People can come find me. And he tried to pull that with me, so I'm like, hey, I'm here.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't think there's ever been a time where I watched an argument online and I thought, wow, Dan Dockich came out of that one looking good. I'm going to say this probably wasn't the worst one, though.
Snow, what, like, you listed where you were at the time, like you gave the cross street, like, as though you were getting picked up by an Uber. And I'm kind of curious, like, what were you doing there? Like, were you at the grocery store? Were you at a bar?
That's his real street of his home address.
Yeah, like, that's where I live.
So you were just out on the porch, like
the actual address online. I figure he could call me.
Snow put on his jorts, lit up a heater out on his porch, and just went shirtless the rest of the night waiting for a fight.
Yeah.
I mean, were you grilling out?
Shout out to Latonia.
All right. Well, fair enough.
On my computer, on my couch, and like, if you're going to pull the I walk out of, I'm not hard to find, like, hey, neither am I. Here are my cross streets. Call me when you get here.
Dan, you and I had a similar situation this past week when you came at me for the new Nuggets gif. Would you like to state your grievances?
Just find it to be a disturbing, cursed image. That's all. And I wish you would go back to some of the previous ones you utilized. But, you know, there's no accounting for taste. And it's just another sign of the coarseness of the public discourse on social media.
I think
it's really sad, to be honest.
We have some deleted segments that clearly prove Rick has no taste when it comes to that.
Yeah, first of all, I feel like that shouldn't have come as a surprise to you. Second of all, I think it's very clear that you've now outed yourself as PMI Heel. That's your burner account. I think that's pretty obvious after this.
I will say, I don't like, sometimes I feel like we shouldn't talk about what happens on the message board on the podcast, because something in the back of my mind thinks that there might be somebody who listens to the podcast that isn't a huge dork and is on the message board and just hears this and their skin crawls.
No one listens to the podcast.
With humiliation. No one listens to the podcast anyway. So I don't know. We're speaking into the void here. He actually was complimentary toward me, which positively disposed me toward him. And maybe you're just all attacking him for expressing new ideas.
Okay, that's your burner account. Very obvious at this point. Okay, let's get into some Xavier basketball. And I think you look back at last year, which we really haven't talked about much since the season ended, or at all for that matter. I think the big storyline was the team underachieved from what most people expected for more than half the season, and then the last third of the season they turned it around in a way that I don't think anyone thought was possible after they had lost six straight games in Big East play. I guess my question for you guys is, how much of that turnaround do you feel was legit? Do you think they can replicate that now that we know the four main guys from last year are coming back?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's, it's not like they went on some freak shooting display for a month where they shot 45% from three and 90% from the foul line. I mean, they improved their shooting slightly, but it's not like all of a sudden they became the Warriors. I don't know what about that stretch isn't sustainable.
I guess the biggest thing was just and as Snow says, I mean, offensively they got better, but it wasn't like some massive leap forward. The big thing was that they went from being an absolutely terrible defensive team to, I think Travis has said, I don't have a way of verifying this, but I believe him when he says it, that they were a top 25 KenPom defensive team from like Valentine's Day on or something like that. And that bore out when you sat down and watched the games. And who knows why that was. Maybe it was finally going to that the too big lineup and not having to sort of legislate for having to cover for Ryan Welledge. Maybe it was the major core players really buying into the system and not freelancing as much. Maybe it was just confidence. Maybe it was just getting the lid off, as we talked about against Creighton. But yeah, they absolutely turned things around. I mean, they went from 201 to like 102 in defensive efficiency in KenPom over the course of those last 10 games. And let's be honest, they had Villanova by the neck in the Big East semifinal and were in a situation where they would have gone in to play, I guess it was Seton Hall, in what would essentially have been a 50-50 game to win the Big East tournament. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with Snow again. I mean, I think as we're going to talk about in a little bit, there's no reason to believe that the four sort of cornerstones of the team are going to be worse this year than they were last year. There's a reasonable assumption that they're going to improve. And I think, as we're also going to talk about, the pieces that are around them ought to be better this year. And because there are just more pieces on the team, a lot of the issues we saw at the end of games with fatigue should be mitigated somewhat. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a very solid foundation to build on. I think it was really important for the coaching staff, for the players, to build that momentum headed into the offseason, even though obviously the NIT is stupid and they lost a game to Texas that they should have won probably. And
I'll say this, Dan, I'll go on the record. They did not throw the game against Texas. Let's make that very clear. They wanted to win. Everybody in that locker room was mad that they lost. 24 hours later, I'm not sure anyone was mad that they lost.
Agree. Well,
also the NIT is checks notes stupid.
Yeah,
I will go on record that the NIT is stupid. Yes,
like because let's be honest, like at that point, like you're going to beat Colorado at home by 25. Then you got to go all the way to New York. You were just in Madison Square Garden. It's not really that special to you anymore. Like, you extend your season by 3 weeks. No one wants to be practicing that long. You just don't.
Yeah, Dan, you mentioned about whether or not Steele's stat about them being top 25 defensively in KenPom. I'm not good enough at math to figure that out either, but I'm going to guess when you jump, 60 or 70 spots in about a month, it's probably accurate. You mentioned the four guys returning and their improvements. Which of those four guys do you expect to improve most heading into next year?
Man, that's a good question. I guess when I look at the four of them, it's like there are different things that I'm looking for improvement from each one, and I don't know.
Answer the question.
Okay, the answer is probably – the answer for me is Quentin Gooden. I think last year he had struggles that were both that probably began off the court, but also which we won't get into, but is a legitimate thing. He obviously had nagging injuries, sort of the same kind of like stress, repetitive motion injuries he's kind of struggled with throughout his Xavier career. And I think I just don't think he was mentally on point for huge amounts of the season. I think it got better toward the end of the year. But, the thing with Quentin is he doesn't have to be an elite playmaker for this team because he's got dudes around him that can make plays. He needs to be a steady presence who doesn't make a whole lot of mistakes, who runs the offense in an efficient way. But I think what I want to see from him next year is like – and maybe this is – hopefully this is the feedback he got by going through the pro process, but make himself into an elite defender. Like, try to be the best defensive player in the Big East next year. I'm not saying that's possible, but – certainly he's got the physical skills to do it and just totally buy into that, because I think I really think he's the guy that could push it to a different level this year.
I think that's a good point, especially because we saw some glimpses last year where Quentin was locked down in key moments. I think one of the Marquette games, he played really well defensively. But Snow, who do you think it's going to be?
I don't think his numbers will improve. like in terms of counting stats, but I think Najee Marshall's going to make the biggest jump. I think he's now comfortable being the best player, knows how to be the best player, and I think he's going to be – I think he got humbled a little bit when NBA teams had as much interest in him as they did in me and Rick. So I'm actually expecting Najee Marshall to make the biggest impact, the biggest change. No, I think his usage overall will go down, but I think his efficiency and productivity will go up. So I'm going to say Najee Marshall. One interesting thing about Quentin Gooden, he has an outside shot of becoming the all-time assist leader in the history of the school. And if that's something he focuses on, and let me go on record, I don't think he will, but if that's something he focused on and really made a priority, that's where I think this team could make its next step, if Quentin Gooden's a 6.5 assists a game guy this year, which he could be. And if he does that, he could be the all-time assist leader at the school, and that would count for something.
That's interesting. I didn't realize he was that close.
I don't think a lot of people do.
Well, I guess the reason it's a longevity thing too, right? Because he's played so many more
games than like Ralph Lee. I mean, he'll have average like 2 assists a game more than Quentin, even if he breaks the record. But you just play so many more games.
Well, and you also think about Quentin's career, and essentially once Edmund Sumner got hurt, he was playing 38 minutes at the point the last half of his freshman season, and really has continued to do that throughout the last 2 years as well.
Well, and look at those first 2 teams he played on too. It wasn't like he was on a rebuilding team that couldn't score. Like, he had guys just knocking. He dribbled up, threw it to the wing, and they had a 3 for him. You know, so I mean that helped that he had guys around him those first 2 years to sort of get him going for sure.
Rick, who's your answer for that question?
I think both of you brought up really good points, actually. I think Quentin Gooden is my answer too, mainly because he has the most upside. He had the most down year last year. I think he was below expectations by everyone's standards, his, the coaching staff's, and certainly the fan bases. I don't know like what this year will have in store for Quentin Gooden, but I do think last year was more about not only him not feeling comfortable in his role and not exactly understanding what it was, but the entire team being in that situation. I think it put Quentin in some tough spots because he was the guy with the ball in his hands most of the time when the entire offense didn't really know what they were doing, who should have the ball, who wanted to take the shot. They all took their turns wanting to be that guy, but no one really emerged until late in the year when Najee finally got it going, and you kind of had that two-man thing going between him and Paul Scruggs. So I think that will definitely help Quentin, that everyone understands their role and seems a little bit more bought in heading into next year. But Dan, your point about him being a great defender is a good one, and Snow's about him being the assist leader is a good one, because for Quentin to be at his best and be most productive for this team, he has to be an ultimate glue guy. He has to be good at all the little things and making everyone else around him better, whether that's on offense or defense. If he can do those things, I think he could be one of the better point guards Xavier has seen. But he's going to have to tweak a few things, obviously, and make a little bit better decisions this coming season. So I think that's going to be a big storyline for Xavier this year and what their ultimate upside is.
Kind of just piggybacking on that, I'm curious if either one of you two guys have any insight. Obviously, these four upper-class returnees all tested the NBA draft waters. Do you guys get a sense of, like, what feedback they got in terms of things that they need to focus on and what we might see special attention paid to over the offseason?
I mean, it's nothing you wouldn't expect. I mean, three of the four were told you got to shoot better. You know, Najee, it was told, like, you know, what the hell are you doing on the court half the time? Stuff like that. It wasn't, since none of them were really all that close to being drafted, it was all the obvious stuff you would think. Of the four, the only one that NBA teams really had any interest in was Paul, because he can shoot and they like his toughness. They feel he makes winning plays. But, you know, in terms of, it's obvious what those guys need to work on. And that's what they were told.
Yeah, I think that it's a little bit different maybe, and granted, even with like Trayvon Blewett, we knew exactly what his game was. We knew exactly what they wanted to see from him, which is get in better shape, become a better athlete, improve your body as much as possible, and maybe improve your game off the bounce a little bit. But like I think it's you get a little more feedback, a little more specific stuff when you're an actual NBA player and they see you as a prospect. Whereas, I mean, Xavier's guys right now, aside from Paul Scruggs, I think Zach Hankins was a bigger NBA prospect than any of the other three this offseason. So, like Brian says, it's all the things we've been talking about these guys. It's all the things you read on the message board about these guys. They got to make shots. You know, Quentin needs to make better decisions as a point guard. All that typical stuff. So I don't think it'll be anything shocking there. Sort of on that same topic, though, Brian, do you feel like everyone should safely assume this is the last year that they'll get to see Najee Marshall and Paul Scruggs?
I would go in with that attitude, but there's odd amount of confidence. Confidence isn't the right word, but odd amount of thought that both that those guys aren't as locked into leaving as people might think. I'll put it this way. I was far more like Trayvon Blewett flat out told them he's not coming back for a senior year, and he did. But if you make me guess, like I would say 60-40, both are gone, but you know, I don't think anything's set in stone. But I would go in with that attitude like this is the last time you're going to see those two.
Yeah, I think that's right. We mentioned the four main guys coming back. Dontarius James is returning as well. We kind of expected Keontae Kennedy to leave after he left the team in the middle of the year. I think a lot of people thought Dontarius might as well, but he's remained with the team through this point, and it looks like he's going to be back next season. Do you see any upside for him on next year's team, Brian?
If he can really make shots, I mean, there's no one like him on the roster, realistically. I mean, everyone, because of his skin tone, thinks Jason Carter's this super skilled perimeter kid. He's not. Dontarius is the best front court shooter on the team. So if he can learn his way on the defensive end, gain some trust in the from the coaches, and make shots, yeah, there's some upside for him because, you know, he's a decent enough athlete. He's a big enough body. He can rebound a little bit. You know, if he can not hurt you on the defensive end, pick up the system and make shots, yeah, there's a role that can be carved out. I'm not counting on it, but that's the upside.
Yeah, I mean, the flip side of what Brian mentioned a minute ago is over the last couple of years, we have looked at this team and there's been these four dudes who basically were the entire returning roster for 2 years, and we knew we were going to get huge minutes. And there's a very high likelihood, as Brian just said, that all four of those guys are going to be gone next year. And so there are going to be lots of opportunities, and that's why, you know, what Coach Steele and staff are doing on the recruiting trail in 19 and 20 is so critical. But also, and bringing in a guy like Jason Carter who has 2 years of eligibility. But Dontarius is going to have a chance. I mean, he doesn't have to carve out a huge role for himself this year, but if at least he can put himself in the frame to get minutes as a junior, I mean, maybe he sticks around, maybe he fights it out. I mean, I'm glad that he stayed. I don't know that they were going to be able to find somebody to use that scholarship on that was going to be useful this season. And so why not? I mean, he as Brian says, he's got some skill sets that they don't have duplicated in the roster and are in accord with the way basketball is going. I mean, I still think he's a bit of a lottery ticket, but I mean, what the hell at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Travis Steele ever plans on using all 13 scholarships, and Dontarius James is a hell of a practice player. If that's the worst case scenario, is he's a scholarship guy that you have in practice every day, you can live with that because you weren't going to use a scholarship anyway. Looking at the grad transfers they brought in, you mentioned Jason Carter, Bryce Moore also coming in as well. I think Carter, everyone expects to have a big role. I think we all see him as that fifth starter. But Brian, more specifically, how do you think he kind of fits in with those other four guys that are going to be returning in terms of that lineup and starting rotation there?
You know, I think he fits in well because I know I just got done saying that he's not the most skilled guy in the world, but, you know, he does have some skill, certainly in the mid-range, certainly off the dribble. Gives a little bit, and he's a good rebounder. He's a versatile post defender. I think you can use him in a variety of different ways that they couldn't with their four man last year. And, you know, at the end of the day, he's just good. And, you know, he's a good enough athlete where he can defend on the perimeter. So I just think he gives them so many more roster options. especially if the young big guys aren't ready right away. And again, I mean, I just think he's a double-figure scorer with 5-6 rebounds per game, and that's a pretty valuable thing.
I think one thing, too, you kind of mentioned his skill set. I think the best way to describe it, he's just very comfortable with the ball. Like, you see a lot of bigs, they, you know, when they start to dribble or whatever, they need to look to get rid of, or they need to be making a move and going to shoot. They can't. He's comfortable. He knows how to play with the ball in his hands. He can dribble. He can see the floor while he's doing that. I like his game a lot in terms of how he fits in. But again, he's a guy who can stretch the floor a little bit, but he's not going to be a knockdown 3-point shooter. He's a guy that can make some plays off the bounce, but you know, he's not quite Ethan Happ necessarily. So I think it'll be a really solid pickup for Xavier. What about Bryce Moore, though? I think that one gets a little bit more interesting. How much do you think he can add to this roster?
I think he's a very big addition. You got a 22-year-old kid, and 22 kid sounds stupid, but you got a 22-year-old who's an elite defender, who's proven that already in college, who's really smart and can make threes. And what this does is, where Xavier ran into problems last year is Paul, Najee, Q, and Tyreek are all really good, but they're not all really good when they're on the court together. The problem was you had to have them on the court together. A guy like Bryce Moore can come in and he gives Q a rest, or he gives Paul a rest, and, you know, hell, he even gives Najee a rest depending on how you want to run the lineup, and all of a sudden you have extra shooting out there. You don't lose anything on the defensive end. If anything, you gain something. And then beyond that, if Quentin goes to Planet Quentin and he just starts handing the ball to Marquette's guards, you've got someone who can guard Marcus Howard as much as anybody can guard Marcus Howard. And he's built to do that. I actually think this is a key addition, and I think he'll actually play a little bit more than people think.
So the devil's advocate would say Xavier again, kind of, and I don't, just to be clear, I don't believe this. I'm just setting the straw man up for you guys. But devil's advocate might say, oh, here we go again, plugging holes with grad transfers from lower level teams that, I mean, how do we have any, why do we have a reason to believe that these guys are going to be bigger impact guys than, say, Wellage and Castlin were last year, who, quite frankly, weren't probably up to the standard that Xavier needed in Big East play. I mean, I'm assuming you guys don't have those concerns with these two guys.
No, I mean, I think that those are fair concerns and criticisms. Like, if you ask me my questions about this team, it is the fact that you are once again relying on two grad transfers, and Jason Carter's going to be around for 2 years, but when you have guys that are just kind of coming in cold and expected to play right away and learn your system immediately and fit in with new teammates, I don't think that's a sure thing. When you factor in they're making a jump up from mid-major basketball to the Big East, I don't think that's a sure thing. Those would be my biggest question marks. And then obviously you factor in that last year's team didn't have anyone who could shoot. So whether it's Bryce Moore or one of the freshmen, someone is going to have to be able to shoot this year. Those are my main questions. So I think that's a fair, I don't know if it's a criticism, but at least a question to have about this team going into the season.
I think it's fair to have that question, but where it falls apart is you knew Ryan Wellage had physical issues in terms of matching up, and there was nothing that could be done about it. And you knew that, you know, Kyle Castlin, let's be obvious, he was an average Ivy League player. Whereas Bryce Moore, the two things he does, make open threes and defend, really, you know, you're not asking him to be a creator. You're not asking him to be something he's never been. So his skills are more transferable. And then Jason Carter's just good. He just happened to be playing in the MAC.
Yeah.
I mean, he would probably be the MAC player of the year this year.
Yeah, I don't have many concerns about Carter. I think he's a pretty low floor guy.
Yeah.
And then with
high floor.
Yeah, I'm sorry, high floor guy. I think you're right about Moore, though. The thing about him that jumps out is, one, you know he can at least defend. I don't think there's any question about that. And then when it comes to his shooting, yeah, I guess there could be some concern that, well, what if he can't get his shot at the Big East, or what if he can't free himself against better athletes? But to me, he looks like a legit shooter, and what I mean by that is he's not, you know, a Brad Redford type of guy that needs to be wide open with his feet set off the catch. he can move around. He can get it off of all different types of actions, running around screens with guys chasing him. He hit tough shots for Western Michigan, and he moves well. So I don't think there's the same concerns, and I think you're right that there's more the skill set that those guys bring to the table. It transfers a little bit better than sort of what you were looking for from a guy like Kyle Castlin last year, for instance.
Yeah, like Wellage was going to be physically overwhelmed. Carter's not physically overwhelmed. You know, Bryce Moore has a carrying skill, which is his shot making. Kyle Castlin had no carrying skill. He just didn't have a complete glaring weakness, or so you thought. Those are two very different things. So while the concern is valid, and there's obviously no guarantee, these guys are built a little bit differently than the last guys were.
I think the other thing that sets this year's team apart from last year's team is just the fact that they have more depth and more bodies. I mean, there's no guarantee that Zach Fremantle or Daniel Ramsey or Deontay Miles is going to be ready to roll from day one, but I'm willing to bet that one of the three of them will be able to give minutes, and maybe two from day one. And, you know, Kiki Tandy, Demir Bishop, they both have had really impressive high school careers, really impressive AAU or grassroots basketball, whatever you want to call it, statistics. They have an ability to score. I mean, just when you look at the possibilities that the guys that Steele can bring off the bench to spell these guys, it's a lot different from last year when really it was very difficult for Travis to go beyond, you know, maybe his sixth man on his bench without really having to compromise what he was trying to do on the court. So I think that makes a huge difference as well. You're not going to be running, you know, Najee and Paul and Quentin completely ragged the way they were by, you know, the beginning of March last year.
Well, and since Dan made that move into the freshman, Brian, let's talk about the roles there. Who do you see being the biggest impact out of the freshman?
Probably Fremantle, because he has the clearest path to playing time. You know, Tyreek's not going to play more than 25 minutes, most likely. You know, 28 minutes, maybe. And someone has to play the five. And Carter could do it, but I think Fremantle's got a clear path to playing time. And he has the least adjustment as a big. He's not going to be asked to run the team. He's not going to be asked to, you know, there's a lot of different things a guard has to go through that a big doesn't in that regard. So I would say Fremantle probably has the biggest role, with also Kiki Tandy, because he's the most natural shooter scorer, and this team can use that. And to go with that, he's already physically a beast at about, you know, 6'1", 6 feet tall, however tall he is. So physically, he's going to be ready. Athletically, he's ready. And at some point in time, it might just be for 5, 6, 7 minutes, you're telling him to go out there and hoop. And so I think Kiki will have the second biggest one. I'll be interested to see with Damir Bishop, though. I want to know how ready he is right away. That's going to be really intriguing to watch once he gets on campus on Saturday.
Yeah, I think most people kind of feel that, you know, the fan base is certainly really excited for Kiki Tandy. I think the expectations for him have kind of hit a fever pitch and are probably a bit too high at this point. And then Fremantle seems like the most ready out of the guys. And like you said, there's the playing time for him, so that makes a lot of sense. Out of the other guys, though, do you think, I mean, you mentioned Damir Bishop. It sounds like you think he could be in the mix to fight for some playing time this year. Do you think there's any available minutes there for Ramsey or Miles? Do you think they can fight their way in, or do you think those guys are kind of more developmental guys at this point?
I think Miles is definitely going to redshirt. I think there's a chance for Ramsey. You know, he didn't have a tremendous senior season, but again, you know, he's kind of young for his grade. He's big. He's athletic. You know, he can really rebound. It wouldn't shock me if he finds a way on the court. I would be pretty damn surprised if Deontay Miles doesn't redshirt, though.
One thing I will definitely say is that Travis and Xavier's program as a whole are very fortunate to have managed to keep Jonas Hayes this offseason, because with those three young big men coming in, to have an excellent positional coach like that in place, ready to get them off on the right foot, is going to be a big advantage, I think.
Yeah, Jonas did a good job with the bigs last year. I thought there was clear growth, you know, both in the offseason and during the season. And, You know, he's obviously got a great relationship with Daniel Ramsey, and he's built one with Zach Fremantle. So, and then Deontay, you know, he's going to be in right away. And but again, I just don't see him playing this year, so it's not as relevant. But I think, you know, having that continuity and a known quantity is a very good thing.
Someone asked about the assistant coaches. Like you mentioned, I think Jonas did a great job working with the bigs. I think he more than lived up to expectations. Brian, Ben Johnson was working with the guards last year, right? What have you heard about him in terms of sort of the impact he made on last year's team?
I mean, I think sometimes that stuff can be overrated. Like, the head coach is still the coach. But, you know, I think he did a fine job. I think Dante Jackson did a fine job with the wings. At the end of the day, though, like, the head coach is still running practice, so, and he's still running workouts. But yeah, I mean, I think those guys showed that they know what they're doing, and the players respect them and are comfortable, and that they're capable of getting better.
Do you think, you know, with the newcomers that we just talked about, do you think there's going to be any stylistic changes to how Xavier plays, whether that be on offense or defense?
Certainly on offense. They don't want to play as god-awful slow as they did last year. I mean, they did it for two reasons. One, because their guys had to play so many minutes. And two, because they found out that they got better shots playing that slow. But this upcoming year, I don't think they want to do that. I think they want to play with a lot more pace, you know, get a lot more to the rim, you know, run a lot more motion. I think there's no doubt that they want to play faster, utilize their athleticism, toughness, offensive rebounding ability. I think you'll see that. Defensively, it's going to be interesting. I don't really know what the heck to expect. Because they were so good at the end of the year. Do you really want to mess with that? But I also think it's a team that can apply a little bit more pressure if they wanted to, even within pack line principles. So I'll be interested to see. I really don't know the answer. I think part of that's going to come in Spain and just kind of figuring out kind of what works best for this team.
I think that might be the thing that the Spain trip and those extra practices provide as much as anything, is kind of the staff given a chance to sort of get that feel back for, okay, should we switch some things up defensively here? I don't think they're going to be a team that starts pressing a ton. I mean, we heard about that being added a little bit last year. They ended up playing like 50 possessions the entire season of, you know, of press. So like it's not going to happen a lot. But I do think they could tweak some things a little bit. But like you said, they finished off the year so strong, even though you're kind of like in a makeshift year with a plug and holes type roster. I still don't know how much you want to really tweak the way things were working at the end of the year. So I think those practices will give them a good opportunity to take a look at that. In terms of the timeline here for this offseason, I mean, guys are arriving on campus this week or the weekend, right?
Saturday, the 15th.
Saturday. So they'll be on campus soon. Workouts will start shortly after that. And then it'll be very end of July. They'll get those 10 practices before they leave on that Spain trip. I think it's the 7th. They leave like August 7th or something like that. So that's sort of how this summer sets up for the team, right, Brian?
Yeah, I don't know exactly when they're going to start practicing and, you know, whatever. But, yeah, it's going to be – they're going to have their 10 days of practices that I think you can practice as long as you want. Now, I think it'd be ridiculous to practice for a long time, but, you know, I think you can practice as long as you want. Then, of course, they have their 8 hours a week of workouts. I mean, there's going to be a lot going on. You know, moment these guys get on campus, Matt Jennings is going to do science experiments on them. So, you know, it just is what it is.
What are there any drawbacks, in your opinion, to the season starting so early? Do you think that played a role?
Oh, hell yeah. I don't know that there's any way to quantify it, because you don't know what would happen if a team didn't go on a foreign tour. But I think there's real danger of the season becoming too long and you peaking in December and January instead of March. I think that's a real concern.
Does that change at all when you're relying on freshmen, especially?
I don't know. I would get worried personally that you're going to make it just way too long. And especially if you use these practices like true preseason practices where you're going 2.5 hours. I mean, these guys aren't used to that. So do they wear down in March? I don't know that it matters if you're a senior or a freshman. If you're not used to it, you're not used to it.
Right. Well, one thing I want to kind of circle back to here before we look ahead to next season a little bit more. We talked about the assistant coaches, but I do know people on the message board were asking about Travis Steele specifically too. I guess we know Dan's did based on his social media usage, but did your guys' opinion of Travis Steele change at all since he took the job? I mean, in terms of, is he the right guy? Did your confidence raise or lower or anything like that?
Rick, I texted it to you. You know, there's a lot of reasons the Travis Steele era can fail, just like there's reasons that any coach can fail. But I think it's pretty clear one of them isn't because he can't coach. I think that became very clear last year that guy knows what the hell he's doing when the game starts. So, sorry, Dan. But, I think it was the most logical hire, and I have no reason to believe that it's not going to be successful. And you talk to people who are around a lot, even former players who aren't around a lot, but, you know, kind of check in from time to time. They have the utmost confidence in the direction that it's going under Steele.
Go ahead,
one brief temper tantrum notwithstanding. view of what Travis has done, belief that this was always going to be the right hire is as strong today as it was 14 months ago. I'll tell you what, there's a lot of things last year where I think factors that were just beyond his control put this team in a bad spot. But I will say this, being able to get out of that skid and to end the season in the way that they did last year was absolutely an incredible job. And I understand when you look at those games that there was some luck tied into it, but just being able to get into that, to be in a position like they were with the season just completely spiraling out of control and with, especially as a first-year coach, and being able to get the car back on the road and then make a very strong push to like I said earlier in the show, the brink of playing for a Big East championship and in an NCAA bid. I mean, that's getting with it. And the other thing is that throughout this entire time since he's taken the job, they have absolutely been kicking ass in recruiting, and that was such a critical thing because, albeit that there was a core that stayed on after Chris left, but there was not a whole lot in the pipeline, as you guys know, especially given that last summer that Chris was coach, where kind of the staff at the time struck out on all their key targets. There was basically a lost recruiting class in there. And so what he's done thus far with the 2019 class, a top 20 class, top 20, 25 class, and then what they've done so far in 2020 with Dwan Odom and CJ Wilcher, and hopefully a couple more guys on the way, which you guys have been talking about quite a bit on the message board. I think all signs point to positive. What we've just got to see is we've got to see it happen on the court this year.
Yeah, my opinion of Steele hasn't changed at all. I think it'd be unfair to base any coach off of their first year, especially when you've got kind of a makeshift roster like that. But it goes both ways for me. Like, I didn't change my opinion when they lost six games in a row. I didn't think that would have been fair. I also didn't think because he turned it around at the end of the year that, like, he's the greatest coach ever and everything's going to be great going forward. I had confidence in him already going into that based off of what I knew. I also think when you look at how other jobs have gone in terms of the hiring processes since Xavier made their hire, you start thinking about who Xavier probably would have ended up with. It's probably someone who missed out on the NKU job this past year. So if that makes you feel a lot better, I don't, you know, like I think it's pretty clear they've got the guy you would want now based on who else they would have been looking at and who's been hired other places. So I think Trav still has a lot to prove, but I think they've got the right staff in place. And I think that the assistants that he put together, I mean, you look at John Brandon, who just got the UC job. He has assistants from NKU and Winthrop. That's a big difference from Travis bringing in a guy like Jonas Hayes and a guy like Ben Johnson to go along with Adante Jackson. So I think to me that was probably the most impressive thing he's done since he's gotten here is the hiring of the assistant coaches. All right, let's take a look at next season. Just real quick here, the non-conference schedule came out. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because we'll do the win-loss game and stuff before the season starts. But there's not a lot of meat on this bone. I mean, you start looking at you've got Missouri at home. You've got the Charleston Classic, which includes Florida and Miami. You've got the Crosstown Shootout at home. And, I mean, you go to Wake Forest and TCU, I guess? Like, what's your thoughts on the schedule, Brian?
The NCAA Tournament Committee made it very, very clear. We don't want you to schedule terribly, but we want you to win games. And Xavier said, okay, that's what we're going to do. They take their cues from the NCAA Tournament Committee. That's what they do. If beating bad teams counts more than losing to good ones, what should you do? Beat average teams. So they scheduled games that they're going to win against average teams. If you're given the answers to the test and you ignore them, you're an idiot.
Dan, did you have any thoughts on that? The release of the schedule this year?
I mean, same thing Brian just said. I mean, when you look at last year, I mean, you do kind of wonder, Xavier's. The three of us griped a little bit about the non-conference schedule last year. The perception being it wasn't very good. Well, if they'd have played two low majors instead of, say, Wisconsin and Missouri, and beaten those two teams, I mean, just judging some of the decisions that the selection committee made, they would have been in much better shape just because their record was better. Their win-loss record was better, even if their strength of schedule was worse, even if their strength of victory was worse. So it's the same thing. You know, Rick, I remember when we started doing this podcast like 5 or 6 years ago, we had Mario on postseason one time. And it was the year that basically the NCAA had completely ignored KenPom and it used the RPI basically to seed. It was the year that Xavier ended up in the first four. And Mario was just like, I don't think we put this part of it out, but Mario was like beside himself. Like, this is not what they said they were supposed to value. This is not what they said they were supposed to value. But Mario's a smart guy. The next year, it was the same committee. They changed their scheduling approach to make sure that their RPI would be shored up. And that's what I'm sure he did as he looked at this one. I mean, this is their mission, as he's stated every single time, is to put Xavier in the best possible position to get the highest possible seed in the NCAA tournament. And if that means putting together a non-conference schedule that lacks some marquee games, but gives them the opportunity to bank wins, that'll give them that opportunity to move up the S-curve, that's what he's going to do. And you can't blame him. That's his job. And that ultimately is what we all want. So I don't have any complaints about it. It's completely rational.
We're seeing some preseason top 25 polls come out. Xavier has been included in a decent amount of those recently, especially since the four returners announced that they were coming back. Is Xavier an NCAA tournament team? Would you have them in your top 25 preseason right now?
Yes and yes. How many teams return their top four scorers? How many teams return their top four minute guys? You know, what, three of their top four rebounders, their top three assist guys? I mean, off a team that was legitimately a top 50 team, if they're not a tournament team, that means they underachieve greatly. I mean, it's pretty simple.
I probably would agree, but I won't profess to be as to have studied sort of the national perspective as much as Brian has and as much as you have, Rick. So I mean, it feels like if they take a step forward from what they were last year, they should make the NCAA tournament. But, you know, we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, I think not making the tournament would be a big, big letdown for this year's squad. The top preseason top 25 team, it doesn't really mean a whole lot. I don't know that I would have – I mean, they'd be borderline to me. I don't think I'd have them in right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if they play their way into that, you know, a couple weeks into the season after we see them beat up the likes of Jacksonville, Siena, and Missouri. That will really get the voters aroused. So I think the next topic on the list would be 2020 recruiting. You know, Dwan Odom, he's been committed for a long time now. Brian, kind of give us the update. What have you seen from Dwan Odom this spring? How has he been playing?
You know, he's played pretty well. It's been interesting. He's been playing off the ball a lot with Davon Smith. So he's DeJuan's not great off the ball. But when he plays on the ball, he's really good. And that's going to be his role with Xavier. He's going to play on the ball. He's going to be a point guard. And when he does that, I mean, he can do some things now. Like, he is so athletic and so twitchy. He gets into the lane, and then he really, really can pass. Has good feel, is a good leader. Shot making's getting a little bit better. Still got a ways to go there, but it's getting a little bit better. Overall, it's been a good spring and summer for DeJuan. I'm not going to say he set the world on fire, but he's been pretty darn good.
And then the staff just landed their second commitment in the class this past week when they received a commitment from C.J. Wilcher. He's about a 6'5 wing from New Jersey, known as a shooter. What sort of stands out to you about C.J. Wilcher's game, Brian?
First of all, as you said, the fact that he's a really good-looking stroke, can really make shots. Now, he didn't shoot it as well this spring as you might expect, so there's that issue. But, you know, he can really shoot the ball. And then he just, even though he's not athletic, he knows how to create space for himself using the dribble to get his shot off. And then he also knows how to use screens, read screens, set up defenders. He can get open, whereas a guy like Brad Redford could never get open. You know, shouts to Brad Redford. You know, CJ knows how to do that, maybe even a little bit more than like Trayvon did. So, I mean, he's not the player Trayvon likely ever will be, but he can create space for himself, and he knows how to get a shot, which is a big deal.
Looking forward after CJ's commitment, I think, you know, I feel like they probably are looking for two more spots in this class now. How that exactly shakes down, who knows, and obviously you've got grad transfers and regular transfers to factor in there as well. But what else do you think that they need in this 2020 class?
I mean, I think right now the biggest focus is on a legit four-man, and that means Ben Carlson. I would say he is the most important guy left on the board for him, because you look at after Ben Carlson, you know, you got Keon Ambrose-Hilton, who's got a lot of talent but is a high-ceiling, low-floor guy. You got, you know, Darius Miles, who, again, high-ceiling, low-floor type of guy. The board thins out significantly after Ben Carlson, based on what we know. So I think that's someone he is the highest level priority right now. He's decently skilled, pretty good athlete, you know, size, rebounds, smart, competitive. Just made the visit to Stanford. Obviously no commitment was made. That's good news for everybody but Stanford, who's recruiting Ben Carlson. I would say he is as big a priority as it gets. And then after that, you know, you got Colby Jones, who can play a variety of different roles. You know, they're going to host Jay Scrubb on an unofficial visit. He's probably the best remaining – him and Kareem Manet are probably the best remaining talents on the board, who you, if you can get them, you just figure it out. But I would say forwards, you know, whether it's, you know, Jalen Bridges, Ben Carlson, guys I've already mentioned, I would say that's the focus right now.
It seems like, you know, you've got to get a forward. And Ben Carlson seems to be that main target. But then after that, is it kind of just a best available for that next spot where you would almost, if it's another forward, that's fine. If it's a wing, that's fine. You're kind of just looking for what you can get at that point?
Yeah, definitely. Because here's the thing. You brought in five guys in 2019. You would have, let's say Carlson commits, and no, I'm not predicting he commits. I'm just, for the sake of this conversation, another three, that's already eight newcomers in 2 years. It becomes a tough sell, because you can say to a kid, hey, Paul Scruggs and Najee Marshall are leaving, but you don't really know that, and the kid's certainly going to look at you a little cross-eyed anyway, and you start looking at the depth chart, it becomes a really tough sell. So you're just kind of trying to get in where you can fit in at that point.
With that being said, you mentioned, I mean, we haven't seen the five guys from 2019 on the court yet. We have no idea. You know, I mean, we have our thoughts, but we have realistically no idea what they're going to amount to at the college level. Then you have this 2020 class, which could be four guys once again. That essentially makes up your entire roster that we really don't know what they have at this point. How does that affect the strategy for 2021? What is the strategy for 2021 at this point?
I don't think they have a strategy yet, other than
just look at
focus on a couple guys that we think are really good and go after them.
Yeah, that seems right to me. I mean, you just don't know what you're going
to
need.
I think it's too early to have a strategy, quite honestly.
Yeah, I think you just got to get best player available, right?
Yeah, just get good players.
Dan, did you have any thoughts or questions to add to the recruiting discussion here?
I just wanted Snow to have to say nice things about Dante Jackson.
What was with that, GIF, whatever we want to call it? What the hell was with that Jonas posted?
That was fantastic.
How ridiculous did Jackson look?
That was fantastic.
Like, how did C.J. Wilcher not decommit immediately upon seeing that?
So I feel like we need to provide some backstory, because we did provide some backstory with Snow's feud with Dokic. Snow, explain your relationship with Dante Jackson and sort of how it began and why you're so harsh on him.
Young Dante, I've known since he was a sophomore in high school, and to this day will go down as the kid who was the single toughest human being to get on the phone during his high school years. Did not talk to anybody. I'm talking Bruce Brown level, who an assistant coach described to Rick, like the president could be calling and he probably still couldn't get him on the phone. Jackson was kind of the same way in the media. And I'm going to give Jackson no benefit of the doubt, because he made my life a pain in the ass for several years.
But he's done a nice job in terms of
developing a recruitment. He's done a tremendous job. He never recruited a high major player before. In fact, Jackson had never coached, and still hasn't, coached a kid that he signed, that he recruited and signed.
That's right, yeah.
But he's done a great job, to get Damir Bishop, where you didn't start recruiting him really to the end of June, early July, get that done in, I think, September it was, to, go to New Jersey, get C.J. Wilcher over high major schools in the area who, are more natural, easier for him to get to for visits. It says a lot. Then, he's put Xavier in a good position with Jalen Bridges. He's done a really good job. He's good at building relationships. He knows how to sell Xavier. I mean, I think, from a recruiting perspective, he's exceeded all expectations.
Yeah, I mean, when he was hired, I mean, you look at his resume. Obviously, he played at Xavier. He's got connections here, which made it sort of a natural fit. But, I mean, his sort of job history before that, he'd been a grad assistant at Ohio. I think he was at Robert Morris and Air Force and all I think Northern Kentucky maybe for a year, all of them low mid-major type places. So I think there was a certain level of skepticism about whether he'd be able to step into a Big East staff and immediately establish himself as a recruiter. And he has done that without any question at this point.
I don't think anyone's surprised that Dante is personable, that, he loves Xavier and his enthusiasm shines through. Brian, are you a little bit surprised that, the recruiting connections, just in terms of, he didn't have a big AAU program pedigree to lean on where he could just go back and say, DC Assault are my guys, or something like that, like we've seen with past coaches. And especially with him going to the East Coast, are you surprised at all? To me, the East Coast typically seems to be a little more basketball circle oriented. You got to know people to sort of get in there. Are you surprised that he's been able to go to that area and have success?
Yeah, and, land priority guys. I mean, that's the thing. It's one thing if you strike out on three guys and you get your fourth target.
Right.
His number one target was Damir Bishop. Got him. Number one target in this class, C.J. Wilcher. Got him.
Yeah, it's not now, unknown.
Again, the other assistants helped. Jonas, Ben, they helped as well with those guys. But, there's always one lead recruiter. And Dante, with, very little in the way of a pre-existing relationship, if at all, worked his way in with guys that, top 100 caliber type players that traditionally, let's be honest, Xavier's had a hard time getting, even with guys who are connected in that area.
Yeah. Any other questions here that we didn't get to from the message board, from you guys? You got anything else?
Someone asked an interesting question, Rick. This is something that I think we've talked about in the past, but during the Nick Cronin era at UC, it was pretty rare for Xavier and UC to go head-to-head for players. I can only think of a handful. You guys can probably think of way more. But the question was asked whether with John Brannon in position in Clifton, whether or not we could see more Xavier UC battles on the recruiting trail.
I definitely think we will. One, just because I think John recruits the same circles as Xavier a little bit more than Mick did, period. Two, he's going to look for the same type of player more so in terms of it's not just going to all be tough, athletic defenders. He's going to look for more skilled guys. He'll have a white kid on his team occasionally. So that, like, I from that perspective, yeah, I think they will recruit against each other. Also, there's just no way around the fact that Mick was very much a go tell me who I can get type of coach. I mean, he didn't want to get into a lot of recruiting battles. He sort of waited out and then took guys that he knew he could get. Whereas I think John is going to be willing to get into battles that he has no chance of winning occasionally, just because that's more his philosophy on recruiting.
Yeah, I mean, I think John made it clear even when he was talking to assistants throughout the you know, his hiring process, that the way it was done in the past is not the way it's going to be done going forward. You know, he's going to go after the best in the Midwest, and he's going to go head to head with people. And because of that, I expect to see Xavier and UC on the same guys a little bit more often. You know, do I think Xavier and UC are going to be recruiting everybody? No, I don't. But I just think John's philosophy is different than Mick's. Mick was all about fit, all about, you know, who can he coach, personality, the whole deal. John's going to be a little different, at least from what he says and from what we've seen, where it's, you know, he's going to go after talent and you know, he's not going to back down from anyone. He's not going to give up anything.
Another recruiting question that I had for you guys was, you know, when Travis took over the job a year ago, he said a few things about how he intended to recruit. We had some, you guys having known him as long as you have, had some educated guesses about how he might recruit. Let me ask you guys what you've seen that is different about the way that Chris Mack sort of supervised recruiting as head coach at Xavier versus what Travis has done over the last 12, 13 months.
I would say Xavier under Travis Steele is the most organized recruiting staff I've ever seen. Like, literally, it's insane. Now, I actually think the program in general was probably more organized under Chris, because that's one thing he's phenomenal at is, you know, organization from the top down in terms of, you know, the basketball game plan, blah, 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 go down the line. But I think Chris was kind of more of a head coach where he let his assistants kind of do their own deal and then it would get figured out recruiting wise. Travis isn't that way. You know, he's involved in every aspect of recruiting. Each assistant knows everybody that the other assistant's recruiting. They work together. It's just the single most organized recruiting operation I think I've seen. And it's really impressive. And I think that's why it's working out the way it is right now, because of how organized, how focused, how dedicated they are, not only to their own guys, but to helping each other out and just the general knowledge, so that when a kid comes to campus, he's not meeting with three strangers, you know, like the kid already knows who everybody is.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest difference is, we've brought this up a few times going back to last year, is that this staff, they try to recruit as a staff legitimately. And almost every staff will tell you that. Like, every head coach understands that that sounds good to fan base or from a PR perspective of like, oh yeah, we want all of our coaches. It's a family feel. We want them all to get to know the recruit. But the problem with that is, to be able to really do that, one, you have to be super organized, like Snow said, but the head coach also has to love recruiting. Like, he has to be intimately involved in the everyday conversations with these kids and going out to see them a lot. And I would just say, like, Chris did not love recruiting. And that's not a shot at him or a shot at his abilities, because he's a damn good recruiter, as we're seeing at Louisville still. But I think he saw it more as, the assistants go out, they get their priority guys, they bring them back to me, and I close the deal on the official visit type of guy. Whereas I think Travis is more of, like, still in that mindset of, like, he's almost an assistant and he's out there grinding and trying to chase them down still, and he'll recruit his own priorities in addition to the guys his staff is recruiting. So to me, that's the biggest difference, is just that Steele loves the everyday grind of the recruiting, whereas Mack ran it more as like a CEO of, he sort of oversaw it.
Yeah, Mac's kind of philosophy was, it's the assistant's job to bring them here, it's my job to close it. And, you know, that's quite honestly the way 95% of head coaches think. Steele has it a little bit different. It's, you know, he's going to be FaceTiming a kid every night. He's going to be leading the recruiting meeting, not the assistants. It's just different, and it's one of Travis. Every coach has strengths and weaknesses. I would say that's a major strength of Travis's, is his desire, his ability, his want to when it comes to recruiting, as opposed to, you know, other head coaches who, some of them, you know, it's just they'd rather not bother with it and just tell their assistants to get me dudes and let me coach them.
All right. Anything else?
That's up to the great Dan.
I'm good.
All right. You've been listening to another edition of the Data and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. For the legend, excuse me, for the little scout guy, Brian Snow, and Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.